Now listen up.
Coming to you from a toddler's playroom in the Lone Star State. Welcome to Health, Wealth, and a Taste of History, where we ramble and you listen. Bringing you weird history, food science, and the facts you didn't know you needed. Here are your hosts, Bob and Tom.
Hey, historians. Do you have your parties planned and your stretchy pants ready for tomorrow? I know we definitely do. In today's episode, we're going to talk to you guys all about Thanksgiving. You probably think you know all the history behind this delicious holiday, but I bet as we talk, you're going to learn a few things today.
Yeah, you got to have those pants where you can, you know, at least button at the top button or something like that on, or some good gym shorts or something like that. Just be comfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, you see those people, they go to their Thanksgiving dinner and they're all dressed up really nice and neat. And you know what? I want to just be laying around the house in a pair of shorts and a t-shirt and eating as much as I possibly can.
Yeah, I want to eat a lot of food, watch some football, and just relax.
Yeah, just totally chill. We also know that Thanksgiving is a day when, you know, people talk politics and it gets really heated around the dinner table. Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. You need to take some notes today because we're going to give you guys a bunch of holiday stats and trivia that you can use to change any of that political talk around the table. And this is going to be some facts like which president proclaimed Thanksgiving as a national holiday, or who was the first president to actually receive a ceremonial turkey from the National Turkey Foundation, or excuse me, that's actually National Turkey Federation. And exactly what is the National Turkey Federation? Is that like the National Wrestling Association, National Rifle Association kind of a thing?
From the little reading we've done, we've kind of figured out it's kind of like the UN of Turkey for companies instead of nations. So they kind of help with like advertising and marketing for the turkey producers.
Yeah, do all the research and stuff. Oh, that's kind of cool. What about which president received a raccoon as a Thanksgiving gift? Listen, don't worry, because we're really going to dish it all out to you.
So when you think about the first Thanksgiving, what comes to your mind? You probably think Plymouth, the Mayflower, pilgrims running around with their bonnets. That's the story that we've all been told since we were kids. You know, while we were making paper turkey hands and celebrating when the pilgrims sailed over and landed in Massachusetts in 1621. So in the customary history that we're taught that the pilgrims celebrated with the Wampanoag tribe. And then they lived happily ever after, right? Well, according to some Florida historians, they believe that the Spanish Admiral Don Pedro Menendez de Aviles kissed a cross held by the fleet's captain, Father Francisco Lopez, as he waded ashore on September 8th, 1565. So that's when he claimed Florida for both his God and his country. Around that time, there was this indigenous tribe called the Timucuas, and they apparently watched as these 800 newly arrived colonists gathered around a makeshift altar while Father Lopez performed a Catholic Mass of Thanksgiving for their safe arrival and the newly christened settlement of St. Augustine.
So, yeah, you know, they just spent 6 weeks on these ships, these small, cramped ships coming across the ocean. They don't take baths back then. I mean, they're very much not hygienic kind of people. So they had to be really smelling rank after all of this time. And there's 800 of them on a beach, and it's hot. What did those Native Americans actually think about seeing these people? God, they might as well have been going back then. They might as well have been going to the moon or Mars or something, you know?
Yeah, to the natives, they probably could have very well seemed like aliens for all we know.
I'm sure that's why they first initially thought that they were some kinds of gods or something like that. Mm-hmm. All those smelly, stinky ones.
So the Spanish get there, and Menendez, he invites the local Timucuans to join them in a communal meal. And now, when we look at some references about this stuff, we find this guy named Michael Gannon. So he's a University of Florida Professor Emeritus of History. And he writes, it was the first community act of religion and thanksgiving in the first permanent settlement in the land. And he wrote that in his book, The Cross in the Sand.
Yeah, so really, at what point in time do you say which one was the actual first? Because there were Spanish and Portuguese and English and French settlements already in South America and on some of the Caribbean islands. So, you know, they were surely having dinner and giving thanks for all the things that they have.
And having these various communal meals and interactions, ceremonies, potentially.
So other historians say, yes, that America's first Thanksgiving did take place in Florida, but they actually believe it was 40 miles to the north, and it was a year earlier than the one in St. Augustine. There was these French Huguenots. These are Calvinist-like pilgrims, and they held a feast with the Tomekuans as well to celebrate the June 1564 establishment of Fort Caroline, which is in present-day Jacksonville, Florida. French explorer René Julien de Laudonnière, he wrote that we sang a psalm of thanksgiving unto God, and that we beseech him that it would please his grace to continue his accustomed goodness toward us.
Now then, unfortunately, less than 2 weeks after landing, the Spanish attacked Fort Caroline because they believed the French there were heretics and interlopers. Now, that attack led to the death of 130 French Huguenots. And then, a few weeks later, the Spanish killed another 200 French shipwreck survivors at an inlet near St. Augustine. That second altercation was actually eventually called Matanzas, and that's the Spanish word for slaughters.
Yeah, because basically, the French had surrendered. The commander gave his sword over to Mendez and asked for safe passage back to Europe. And Mendez, you know, agreed, said yes. And they were actually separated by a giant river. And Mendez said, send your men over 10 at a time so we can search them. And they did that, expecting that everything would be okay. And what Mendez did was bring them over the next set of sand dunes. And, well, in great Thanksgiving tradition, they slit their throats. And that was pretty crazy when you get right down to it. So all of that bloodshed helped to wash away the historical memory of the Thanksgiving ceremonies that were held in both the French and Spanish settlements in the 1560s until their rediscovery in recent decades. Florida isn't the only state, though, that starting in the 20th century to claim they had a stake in America's first Thanksgiving. Texas, Virginia, and Maine have all said that they hosted the nation's first Thanksgiving in the years before the arrival of the Mayflower. And that kind of goes back to what we were talking about before. Yeah, you had all these other people in the Americas already.
So all these different ideas and concepts of the original Thanksgiving are kind of summed up by James W. Baker. So he's the author of Thanksgiving, The Biography of an American Holiday. And he notes that it was traditional for European explorers, such as Ponce de Leon, upon his 1513 arrival in Florida, to give formal thanks for a safe transatlantic crossing. But these isolated pre-pilgrim ceremonies, they bear little connection to the future American holiday. So while any of these can be said to be Thanksgivings actually celebrated before 1620 and the pilgrims, none were repeated or resulted in spawning any kind of new tradition.
Yeah, they didn't have things like sweet potato casserole.
No,
or green bean casserole.
He basically says that they were just isolated and ephemeral events, and that they don't bear any real historic significance beyond their position in time. And according to History.com, he continues to say, none of these events were made anything of historically, or even rediscovered until the 20th century, and thus they didn't contribute to our modern American holiday tradition. So while America's Thursday Thanksgiving holiday has roots in New England's Puritan Calvinist tradition, there never was a single first Thanksgiving, neither in Plymouth for the three-day harvest celebration in 1621, or in any other place. He points out that the first time anyone claimed that the pilgrims hosted the first Thanksgiving was actually more than two centuries later in 1841. He says, while we can argue the case for Florida or Texas or any other claimant as a true first occurrence of a holiday of that name, it is ultimately a moot point as all of them lack any historical agency in the evolution of the modern holiday.
And that's correct, you know, when you use that word evolution, because really all of our holidays have evolved from some historical point in time with a ceremony that really had not much to do with what the thing like Thanksgiving is today or Christmas. And you got a mashing of the multi-ethnic diversity of America that's putting into these holidays. And then, you know, here we are today with what we have.
Yeah, they basically just end up evolving over time. So what we think of as Thanksgiving and Christmas now, you know, a couple hundred years from now, might look completely different.
Yeah. It's pretty much being driven by advertisement now.
Well, yeah.
Regardless of who celebrated the first feast, we know that stuffed turkey and mashed potatoes, they weren't on the menu during any of that meal. It's like I was saying, they didn't have any sweet potato pie, or they didn't have the one thing everybody seems to bring, but nobody's really quite sure they really like, and that's green bean casserole. So what exactly did the pilgrims eat for that first three-day feast? Well, they believe the meal goes something like this. They celebrated probably with venison, which is deer, some duck, goose, oysters. That just doesn't seem like a typically Thanksgiving type of thing, does it?
No, not
really. Lobster,
really.
Which sounds, wow, sounds really good, right? Mm-hmm. It's fish. And the number one thing that we're missing from the meal today is eel.
Well, eel in the Northeast is actually like incredibly, well, it's still pretty common in the freshwater tributaries, mm-hmm. but it used to be like really, really common. It used to be all over the place. So it makes sense that like if they're looking for food, eel is one of the things that they're going to find.
I remember when we were kids that my dad would take us fishing over in Chesapeake Bay. He retired from the Army up there in that area, and we would throw our lines out and three times out of four, we'd come back with an eel on the line. Plus, they also had pumpkins, and they had cranberries, but not pumpkin pie or cranberry sauce.
Yeah, or relish or any other variation of cranberries. So, the concept of a national Thanksgiving had been around since the start of the U.S. During the Revolutionary War, the Continental Congress, in honor of military victories, issued proclamations declaring several days of thanks. Now, George Washington, in 1789, to celebrate the end of the war and the enactment of the Constitution, he called for a national day of thanks. Now, when he did this, James Madison and John Adams, they had similar proclamations. But there was one person that disagreed, and that was Thomas Jefferson. He disagreed because he felt that the holiday had religious implications, and it didn't belong due to the way they were trying to found the nation, based on separation of church and state. So because of this, there was actually no formal declaration issued after 1815 and really for the next 48 years afterward.
That's quite some time. And, you know, people really, when you take this idea of America and you learn about it first in school and you hear about the names James Madison, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, you know, they were all, you know, signers of the Declaration and they all had the similar ideas and that they all got along, which was very far from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of these guys couldn't, you know, really stand one another and their politics were extremely mm-hmm. different. However, they all did have similar ideas about where politics go.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've been going back and forth in America since the beginning, you know, between, you know, what we want. And it's just a continual experiment that's got us where we are today, which is actually not a bad place to live. You know, really is.
No, relatively speaking, we got it made compared to most of the world.
Yes, we do.
You're listening to Health, Wealth, and a Taste of History with Bob and Tom. We'll be right back.
Now, here's a fun fact. Speaking of our founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin wanted to make, guess what? Wanted to make the nation's national bird the turkey. No kidding, he did. He claimed that the bald eagle had bad moral character.
And somehow a turkey has better moral character
yeah,
than an eagle.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. What's the good moral character of a turkey? I'm not really sure. We'll have to call up the National Turkey Federation to find out exactly what that is.
Okay, well, here's another good one for you guys. Have you ever wondered who was actually responsible for Thanksgiving becoming a national holiday in the U.S.? Well, you're about to find out. So, after 17 years of lobbying for a national Thanksgiving holiday, Sarah Josepha Hale, she was an abolitionist, and actually she was the author of Mary Had a Little Lamb. Well, her fight finally came to fruition. In 1863, President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed an annual Thanksgiving celebration on the final Thursday of November. William Seward, who was the Secretary of State at the time, was the one that actually wrote the proclamation, and then Lincoln issued it. The two men hoped it would help heal the wounds of the nation. So although it's Seward and Lincoln who usually receive all the credit, we can actually thank Miss Hale for never giving up, even after the outbreak of the Civil War in April 1861. She would write editorials to Americans urging them to put aside sectional feelings and local incidents and rally around the unifying cause of Thanksgiving. So after this proclamation, for the next 76 years, Americans would celebrate on the last Thursday of November. And then in 1939, in an effort to spur economic activity during the Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt moved the holiday up a week. However, 16 states refused to honor the holiday shift, and for 2 years in the country, depending on which state you lived in, there was a different day for Thanksgiving.
That'd be rough on planning vacations.
Oh, yeah. So the U.S. Congress then in 1941 actually passed a resolution returning the holiday to the fourth Thursday of November, and then it was standard across the board.
So sending turkeys to the White House as a gift can be actually traced all the way back to the 1870s. A Mississippi man sent a raccoon meant to be eaten for dinner. So instead of making raccoon jerky or raccoon pie or whatever it is you actually would make out of the raccoon, his family decided to adopt her, and they named her Rebecca. Now, this might sound just a little bit crazy, but actually, the Coolidge family had kind of like a Coolidge family farm at the White House. They loved animals. They already had 6 dogs, a bobcat, a goose, a donkey, a cat, 2 lion cubs, an antelope, a wallaby, and a pygmy hippo.
Fun fact about the hippo, his name was Billy, and he was the Coolidge family's pygmy hippo. He was actually born and captured in Liberia when he was very young. What do you call a baby hippo?
I have no idea.
He was
chunky.
A young hiplet, maybe?
A hiplet. So they got this hiplet running around the yard of the White House. Taking huge dumps out there, but they fling it around, right? He was talking about the other.
So Harvey Firestone, yeah, the same Tyre Firestone guy, he somehow came into the possession of Billy, and then Firestone ended up giving him to President Coolidge as a gift. That's a pretty big gift, since Billy was 6 feet long and weighed roughly 600 pounds. And since there were only a handful of pygmy hippos in the U.S. at the time, the Coolidge family actually donated Billy to the Smithsonian National Zoo. Billy then became a stud hippo and sired 23 little baby hiplets.
Yeah, he's definitely a stud.
Which many of the pygmy hippos you see in American zoos today are actually descendants of Billy. So he got to live his life out pretty well, just making baby hippos.
So anyways, enough about raccoons and hippos. Let's get back to talking about turkeys. In 1947, Harry Truman was the first president to actually receive a ceremonial turkey, which he ate for dinner. And that came from the Poultry and Egg National Board and the National Turkey Federation. So JFK in 1963, he was actually the first president to spare the turkey's life that he received as a gift. And then it was a few years later, during the Nixon presidency, that Patricia Nixon would actually accept the turkeys on behalf of the president. In 1973, she sent the turkey to Oxon Hills Children's Farm. And next date, remember, is 1978. A turkey was presented to the First Lady Rosalind Carter, and she actually sent it to Evans Farm Inn to live in a small zoo. So then around 1981, under Ronald Reagan's regime, it was commonplace to send a turkey to live on a farm. And the turkey ceremony became a source of satire for, you know, a lot of the newspapers and stuff. But it's pretty good humor. It's actually a way to kind of lighten things up a little bit. So in 1989, George H.W. Bush, and that's Daddy Bush, gave the first official president pardon. So with animal rights activists picketing nearby, he said, "Let me assure you, and this fine Tom Turkey, that he will not end up on anyone's dinner table. Not this guy. He's granted a presidential pardon as of right now and allow him to live out his days on a children's farm not far from here." Now with that quote, we did go look it up. There's a little bit of grammar in there that just doesn't sound quite right. But then when you start thinking about how his son talked when he was a president, you know, you can see. apple didn't fall far from the bush.
So, all right. I think we've given you historians enough presidential trivia to help with some of the political talk around the table tomorrow. Let's chat about the millions of dollars that is spent on producing food each year and what exactly folks in Ohio ended up needing 525 pounds of sugar for.
Seems so, like a ton of sugar, right? It's just a lot.
Yeah, that seems like an absolutely ridiculous amount.
So we went and looked it up on the NIH website, and each American consumes, on average, 152 pounds of sugar a year.
Maybe that's why we're all so fat.
Yeah, because it's in everything.
So, according to the United States Department of Agriculture, a.k.a. the USDA, so they put out an infographic with the following information regarding Thanksgiving dinner. So, in 2016, that's the latest information we got, unfortunately, but it's still pretty good. So, in 2016, American farmers produced 244 million turkeys, valued at $6 billion, with Minnesota leading the U.S. in production. 9.6 million barrels of cranberries, with Wisconsin being the top producing state. That's a lot of cranberries.
That's a lot of cranberries. 244 million turkeys.
Don't we only have like 330 million people?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like so, almost a turkey a person.
Yeah.
So also over 44 billion with a B pounds of potatoes were harvested, and that was valued at $4 billion. Then more than 1.6 billion pounds of pumpkins.
Wow.
Valued at 207 million, with Illinois actually producing almost 42% of those. Then over 2 billion pounds of green beans, valued at more than $441 million.
See, it's like I said, you know, everybody's eating that green bean casserole in different sorts of ways, but you just eat it. It's not really, yeah.
And then more than 7 billion pounds of sweet corn, valued at $897 million. And over 3 billion pounds of sweet potatoes, valued at $706 million.
Now, that's a dish. Now sweet potato casserole.
I love me some sweet potato casserole.
It's like one of those things we don't typically eat until holidays, but I don't know why. Why should we eat that more often?
I guess.
And it's more like a dessert, really, than something that should be on the center of the table. So how much do you love pumpkin pie? Do you love it enough to want to have a pie that actually weighs 4,000 pounds? Okay, we're just talking about getting fat here, but a 4,000-pound pie? Well, according to the Guinness Book of World Record, the world's largest pie was actually made in New Bremen, Ohio. The pie was about 20 feet in diameter and weighed 3,699 pounds. This was the biggest attraction at the 2010 New Bremen Pumpkin Fest, which is world famous, and we should all know about this, right? Put that on your calendar.
Yeah, if you don't know about the New Bremen Pumpkin Fest,
you're
what
are just
you doing
not
with
in,
your
man.
Life?
Yeah. You know, it's. You know, what's the recipe for the world's record pumpkin pie? Well, listen, all you need is 1,212 pounds of canned pumpkin, 2,796 eggs, that's like 233 dozen, 109 gallons of evaporated milk, 525 pounds of sugar, 7 pounds of salt, and 14 pounds of cinnamon. They broke their own record for a world's largest pie. Their first one was actually baked in 2005 and weighed half of it of what it does now, about 2,020 pounds.
So let's go back to the turkey business real quick. Of the 46 million frozen turkeys that the National Turkey Federation estimates are eaten at Thanksgiving, Butterball LLC claims to sell about 30% of them. I believe it. There's a lot of Butterballs in the store, and that's what I use.
You love those Butterballs.
Yeah. So Butterball accounts for about 13.8 million birds a year. Do you remember in our first episode when we were talking about the four major meat manufacturers, with Smithfield being one of them? Well, Butterball used to be a joint venture of Smithfield Foods and Maxwell Farms, which was an affiliate of the Goldsboro Milling Company. Then the Seaboard Corporation actually bought Smithfield's stake in Butterball in 2010. So, fun fact, did you guys know this? Butterball answers more than 100,000 turkey cooking questions via their Butterball Turkey Hotline each November and December.
It 100,000 questions on the turkey hotline.
I didn't even know they ran a turkey hotline, much less answered that many questions.
Well, actually, this morning on the news on HODA, they did have a woman from Butterball that she is, I think she was like the chair or vice chair president or something like that of the hotline, actually. Hmm. And she was saying that most of the questions, you know, about how to cook the turkey, you know, what temperature it was, what's all this stuff inside of the turkey, the giblets.
Well, that's what you use to make the gravy.
I know. But you got these people that have never done this before, and they pull all that stuff out and go, oh, my God, the guts are still in here.
But you'd think, like, with Google and everything else, like, you'd just type it in your phone real quick.
Yeah, you'd think.
I don't know that I would think to call a hotline. Yeah. And like watch on a video.
Yeah, go to Google, watch a video. So in 1953, an employee at Swanson & Sons overestimated the demand for turkeys. So it left the company with an extra 260 tons of frozen birds.
That's a lot of turkey.
Yeah, but this guy just came up with an astonishing solution. So one of the salesmen, he ordered another 5,000 aluminum trays, came up with a full meal, recruited an entire assembly line of workers to complete what would be the first known TV dinner trays. No idea how well that was going to take off. It was such a big hit that they continued to produce and sell the meals. So in 1954, the first full year of production, the company sold 10 million TV tray dinners.
That's a lot.
Hell yeah. I'm telling you, like, this guy's got to be like some kind of God in Swanson and Sons lore. His name mm-hmm. and picture's probably up on the wall someplace. Or somebody else took full credit for it, and he's just been lost to history.
All right, so we've talked all about turkeys, large pumpkin pies, lots of presidential facts. But what about cranberries and the either loved or hated cranberry relish?
That's so good, though.
I love it, yeah. But Jenna's not a big fan, though.
What I like now is you've seen a lot of it being mixed in with like mayonnaise or mustard or something like that and being put on sandwiches. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's just great. Right. Yeah.
Well, cranberries were eaten by Native Americans, but our modern sweetened canned cranberry relish, that was definitely not on the menu during that first feast, especially since the pilgrims had long exhausted their sugar supply by that November and in 1621. So in 1921, this guy Marcus Uran, he was the first to actually can jellied cranberry sauce, and then he eventually founded the Cranberry Growers Cooperative, which is what we now know as Ocean Spray.
Dun, dun, dun.
So we can thank this Marcus Uran guy for that Ocean Spray TikTok video.
Well, historians, that's all we have for you today, and hope you've enjoyed this episode and learned a few new random facts. We here hope you all have a safe and happy holiday tomorrow. Stay safe. Remember, this is about family and about sharing. And we'll talk to y'all next month.
You've been listening to Health, Wealth, and a Taste of History with Bob and Tom.
That was radical.
The number one audio production for people with nothing better to do.
That was amazing.
For more info, head over to healthwealthandhistory.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time.